This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to NITP's For Your Benefit. We have a great show here and somewhat of a rare show. We have the two co-hosts together with no guest. Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec columnist, seminar presenter. Again, I always say knower of all things federal. Good morning, Tammy.
Hey, Bob. Good morning.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. I'm Bob Lines. I'm an accountant finance type and co-host of the show with Tammy. And we're going to use questions from class that we feel have general but very specific sometimes application. But we're really going to lean on you all. So we're at 202-463-5080. 202-463-5080.
We will confirm that number in case you can't get through.
Oh, boy. 202-465. I'm sorry. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. Now, we're on. It's Eastern time. It's 10:07, and we're off at 10:58. So please call us between those times. And if you're listening other than June 9th, 2014, don't call after 10:58 because we won't be here, but we'll give you the email address for questions to ask directly to NITP. Anyway, Tammy, you had some good news from OPM that we were talking about before coming on air.
Yeah, we always worry about the processing. You know, this whole thing about retirement planning ends with retirement, and a lot of employees worry because there's been so much in the news lately about the delays in retirement processing from OPM. So the news is that at the end of May, the inventory, which is the amount of claims left to be processed, stands at 14,551, which you might think that's a lot. But considering that was over 60,000 claims in around 2011, that's come way down. So the processing time for your retirement could be anywhere from on time. There are some people who are actually getting their first check on time, the full amount.
Whoa.
To an average processing, maybe 90 days. So you might get three interim checks before your claim is finalized. Now, that doesn't mean that if there's problems with your case that it couldn't be further delayed. So if there's some issues with your service credit, or if maybe your divorce decree is not clear, you have any kind of issues with your claim that comes into OPM, that can still cause further delays. But for a clean case, you should be able to get your first retirement check within a short time after you retire. So that's good news.
And we talked before coming on air, and what do you attribute that decrease in the inventory? I mean, still have the same number of people retiring, I guess.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's some lower numbers in the number of people who are retiring. However, OPM has done a lot of things to try to reduce the backlog. The one thing they haven't been able to do is electronic processing because that system just isn't in place. The funding's not there. There's a lot that can be done there, but that's not happening. But what they have done was they hired many more claims examiners, so more people to get the work done. They've also worked really hard with the agencies because sometimes the delays stem from the agency preparing the package because it is paper processing. So there has to be a stack of papers that are put in a specific order and they have to be complete. So OPM has worked well hard with the agencies to try to get that better, you know, to get that more clean case coming into OPM. And even with the employees becoming more aware of what they need to do on the application for retirement to avoid those delays. So I think everybody from the employee all the way through OPM has been working hard to reduce the backlog, and it's starting to show. So that's very good news. Plus, retirements are down. If you compare January of 2014, where we had 17,383 federal employees retire that month, to January of 2013, the number was way higher, it was 22,000. And then even in February last year, it was 20,000 compared to 12,000 this year. So for whatever reason, not as many people are leaving the government this year as they did last year, at least for retirement purposes.
Okay, great. Let's start off with an email question from our good friend on the West Coast. And he sent several in this week. And first one's right on target. All of these are going to be on target. And the question is, when does it make sense for a 50-year-old to convert from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA? Secondly, can you give us an example of the state and federal taxes in California for a retiree? Finally, what is the contribution limit on the TSP based on? Do you see the limit increasing next year? Ooh. You want me to do that?
Yeah, go ahead. Go for it.
And you jump in because you know the stuff I don't know. Anyway, so let's. When does it make sense? Generally, if you're going to convert money from a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, you could do it potentially tax-free by taking any of the earnings that's in the traditional TSP and transfer the money from the IRA that has never been taxed. This would include earnings. Plus, years ago, people got tax deductions for it. And you can transfer that into the TSP with no tax. What would it leave? It would leave the non-taxable amount that was put into the traditional IRA, and you can move that over to the Roth with no tax. It's called, quote, the backdoor Roth, end of quote.
Okay, wait, slow that down because I'm trying to absorb it all as you say it. So you say I have a traditional IRA that's got money in it that I put in there that was after tax dollars.
Got it.
And now it's been growing, and that interest that's been accumulating is tax-deferred money.
Yes.
And so what you're saying is I can take that IRA and split it and kind of skim off the earned income, so to speak, that's never been taxed and move that to the TSP.
Got it.
And then take the money that I put in initially that already I had paid taxes on, and I can transfer that to a Roth IRA.
You got it.
That's cool.
We did a show, you and I, mm-hmm. August 23rd last year, and it had two functions. One, to do this backdoor Roth, and the second one was to get the VC into a Roth. But let's stay with the question then. So let's put some numbers with your example. Let's say that collectively, whether you have one IRA or whether you have five IRAs, they don't care. You just add them all together. The total value is X. Now, included in that value is some money that you put in, like you say, that you didn't get a tax deduction for when you put money into the traditional IRA. And they compare the two numbers, subtract the already taxed money from the other, and move the other over to the TSP via a TSP form T60. 60.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then what do you have left in your IRAs? Money that's already been taxed.
The money you put in.
And you transfer it over to the Roth IRA.
And there's no limit as far as how much I can transfer.
No.
There's no limit of how much money I earn that allows me to do that.
No.
That's been lifted.
It can be disgustingly high or very small. It doesn't make any difference.
So if this is money I'm going to keep in there for a long time, it has a potential of doubling or tripling over the next 20 or 30 years.
And that fits into the gentleman's question.
Mm-hmm.
What does a 50-year-old do?
Right.
Now, if the question was, what does a 65-year-old do, and the answer is scratch your head, because you have less time to make up.
To make it worth doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's interesting. That's a good piece of advice.
And the other question that comes out when you talk about this in class, they'd say, well, gee, if I transfer money into the TSP from my IRA, does that limit my ability to fully fund my TSP? No. So
right.
The funding from the TSP under normal situations is done from a salary. And this has really got nothing to do with this. So this could be many times greater. It could be smaller, but it doesn't impact.
Well, that's how there's somebody in the TSP. I'm not sure who it is, but he or she has over $3 million in the thrift. And you know that didn't all come from just putting money out of their paycheck. So they probably did a transfer from other retirement money into the TSP. So a lot of people don't know you can even do that. But you're right, it's TSP 60, and if you go on tsp.gov, you can look at the form, and in the instructions, it tells you what kind of money is allowed to be transferred into the thrift and what kind you can't transfer in.
And this would include people that came to the government, just like you say, that maybe had money in a 401k plan,
yep.
And they can move it into the TSP. And I believe you, in one of your recent articles, the first homegrown TSP millionaire was just recently, wasn't it?
Well, no, there's several thousand TSP millionaires who got there directly from the thrift. And I've met a few of them, actually. So I've gotten some emails from them. But I've also been at seminars where I've actually had people come up and say, well, aren't there a lot of TSP millionaires? I'm like, no, you're one of the few thousand out of 4.7 million participants. So there's not that many, but the ones who got there kind of surprised themselves. And this is probably not advice for most people, but I asked them, I said, how did you do that? And their answer was, number one, they did it from the beginning. You know, from the beginning of the thrift, they put in the maximum, whatever they were allowed to put in, they put in. And they invested it in strictly CS&I, which are the all stock index funds. They didn't put a dime in G or a dime in F. And that, again, is not advice for every person, because sometimes when you do it that way, you have to be willing to watch in 2008 your close to $1 million balance drop to maybe 600,000 overnight. And most people can't do that without getting scared. But these people, they just gritted their teeth and they let it go, because they knew that whatever went down 30% is going to come up maybe 40%. So they just held in there, and that's exactly what happened, luckily for them.
Good. Now, the second phase of the question, can you give us an example of state and federal taxes in California? Why don't I do federal taxes first, because that's universal.
Everywhere.
Okay. So the federal tax rate structure is as follows. The lowest rate is 5%. Nobody in this listening audience is going to be in a 5% federal state tax bracket. Excuse me, 10%. No one. All righty, because it lasts only a short period of time. And then it goes to 15, then it jumps to 25, then it goes to 28. I would say the, if you will, normal CSRS retiree is not paying 25% on all their annuity, but they're paying it on a good percent of it. Now, FERS now, their income can come from as many as three sources. And they don't have to take all three. They certainly would take the annuity, but the question then is, do they go for Social Security, or do they wait for Social Security to ramp up and they take money out of the thrift to help make ends meet? So collectively, they're probably 15 to 25%. Right? But that's not on every dollar. Again, it's phased in. So then the question is California. California is not a low tax state. They're most likely going to pay after a phase in 8%. Now, that's not on every dollar, but again, it's high. However, I don't mean to drive people crazy, but that's the way taxes are calculated. But other people look at it and they say, well, my effective tax rate is not near that. That's kind of like putting your foot in boiling water and freezing water and saying, well, you know, between the two, it's lukewarm. So the effective tax rate is to take your entire tax and divide it by your income. But remember, that tax is generated by going through three or four different
thresholds, yeah, where it hits that higher limit.
So one should not use the effective rate, because if you're looking at cash flow, the next dollar in is going to get taxed at its higher level.
Yeah, there was an article in a Motley Fool recently, and it was sent by the same listener, so he directed me to it. But I was looking at one of the comments from this article. It was an article about taking Social Security at 62 versus 70, and it kind of ties in with these tax rates, because this guy said, I don't see any reason why you wouldn't take it at 62, because what he said was he claimed his Social Security, which he was maxed out, by the way. So he claimed it at 62. It was reduced by 25%. And over the course of the next 8 years, he was ahead of the game by about $150,000 rather than if he would have waited till 70. But what he said was that from 62 until, I guess, 70, he didn't pay any tax, federal tax, on his Social Security income, which tells me he had very little other income. So he was just trying to live on that Social Security benefit, maybe just a little bit extra income out of his investments or his pension or whatever. Most federal retirees wouldn't have that luxury, because even with their FERS benefit added to their Social Security, they're going to be up in that tax bracket where they're going to have to pay tax on Social Security.
85% of it.
Yeah. So, and also, if he lives a long time, this guy, which he's doing well so far, he still might be sorry he didn't wait. So I don't think that advice is take it at 62 no matter what applies to everybody. I still think you have to think about
it. Did you see the trailing responses to that?
Those were more interesting than the article, I thought.
They were not happy campers. Anyway, we got a caller. Good morning.
Good morning. I've got a question on voluntary contributions.
Come to the right place.
I'm looking at retiring this January 3rd as a CSRS.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, I have nothing in the program right now. However, would that be of any benefit to add right at this point in my life?
Actually, it could be. It depends on how much money you have laying around that you want to put aside into this type of a program. And where we were just talking about the Roth IRAs, this would be an opportunity for you to take money that you have maybe in a bank account or some other place where you have money that's already been taxed and move it into voluntary contributions just so that you can move it from there into a Roth IRA. So then it can grow tax-free. So it depends on if you have some money available that you want to invest in that way.
Now, are you looking at leaving January next year?
2015, I think you said.
2015. Yes, 2015. Okay. My thought process, I'm not asking for a response. If you're a good money manager, the later you put it in, the better. Because when you do put it in, the interest rate, while good, is not maybe as good as you can make on your own money. If you're like me and you're not a good money manager, get it in there.
Well, the other thing he could do, since it's still, 6 months away, 5 months away till he retires, he may have time to put it in and take it out before he even retires. So he can send the check in along with a withdrawal application and have the money moved even before his retirement gets processed.
Sure.
Which might be a way to avoid putting that into his retirement claims processing. So, yeah, if he wanted to do it, I think it right now we're still early June. You could probably get it in there and perhaps even get it transferred. The only thing I would recommend is that make copies of everything, the form that you send in, the check that you send in, everything. That way, if you do get to retirement and it hasn't been fully processed, you can send the copies you made with your retirement to OPM. But it would be nice to get that all done before you retire.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay,
one thing, and I'll add to it. OPM, this is no slight on OPM, has not always been sending out 1099s when the money moves from the voluntary contribution to the Roth. Recently, I've seen them, and I've even suggested people, when I talk to them, request it. Because anytime you move money from one tax-deferred account to another, there's supposed to be a 1099, so the IRS doesn't try to tax it. Mm-hmm. And just request that that be done, but more importantly, list the distribution as X and the taxable portion as zero.
Yeah, okay. And don't be in too much of a hurry, because voluntary contributions, unlike retirements, fall at a lower priority of processing, so it can take longer than even a retirement claim. But like I said, he probably has time to do it before January.
Okay, now the final question to our friend in California, and just this one question: what is the contribution limit on the TSP based on? Well, the if you step back and look at it, depends on your age. It's a certain amount if you're 50 or over, and it's a certain amount if you're under 50. So they call that the catch-up. Right now, the combined amount is $23,000, but if one was not 50, what is it, 17.5?
Yep.
Okay, so that's a lot of money. Now, what was that based on? Years ago, whatever the number was, it was. And you go, well, how did it change? It's indexed to inflation. So years ago, the number was a lot smaller than what it is today, but it's indexed to inflation. But more recently, we didn't see a change in it the last 2 years because inflation is so low. Somebody may remember 2 years ago when they increased it $500. And it was only because there was a succession of low inflation years and finally kicked it in. So it's not going to go up by some odd number every year. It's always going to go up by a whole number, but based on inflation looking backwards. My guess is coming up next year, it'll probably change because we would have had 2 years, close to 3 years, with a look back. And even though the inflation is low, it would probably impact it some way. That's just my guess.
Mm-hmm.
Please don't quote me and say, well, he said it's going to go up $500. No, it's just my guess.
We don't know. Yeah, we usually announce that around mid-October.
Yeah.
Yeah, right after the COLA comes due for the retirees.
Right.
So I never knew there was a correlation there.
And it's the same. The IRAs are the same way. Depending again on one's age, you can put in a certain amount if you're over 50 or over, and one if you're less than 50, but it's all based on that same percentage. Now, that's been slow to react because it has to go up by a certain dollar amount, otherwise they don't give it. But if you multiply a low percentage times a low number, it's going to take more years.
Who are we talking about? They? Is that Congress?
Yeah. Well, it's written into the law that,
yeah,
you know, this will be examined each year, and the inflation rate times whatever will be X. If X is, say, under $500, then it's going to go back on the shelf, mm-hmm, until the cumulative goes over $500.
I see. Interesting.
Okay.
And it's the same for the TSP as it would be if you worked for another employer.
Sure.
So that 17.5 is not exclusively the TSP number.
Exactly. So an individual with a 401k plan. By the way, the TSP is not a 401k plan, but it walks and quacks like one. So, I mean, they're very close relatives, but they're not twins. All righty. Tammy, you always have these great benefit questions.
Do you want me to ask it to myself?
Yes. Okay. Ask it to me. You won't get an answer, but go ahead.
Well, let's see. Let me just pick one here that I've got, because I pulled a few that were recently asked that were pretty standard questions that we get at a lot of seminars. Okay, not that one. I saw one here, so that's a little too complicated to start with. So let me find one here. Okay, here we go. Okay, this was from Sue, and she's actually someone who I've worked with in the training offices for many years, and she's finally going to retire this year, so she's looking forward to her retirement. But she wanted to know, when she retires, should I drop my life insurance down to 25% when I retire? Okay, what she's referring to is FEGLI, the Federal Employees Group Life Insurance. And when you do retire, the basic FEGLI, the one that's based on your salary plus $2,000, you have to decide whether you want it to reduce by 75%, which is what she's asking about, or 50%, or no reduction at all. And what's interesting is, it doesn't matter which one of those choices you choose from, you're going to still maintain the full value of that basic coverage until you're 65. And in her case, she's retiring around, I think, around 55. So for the next 10 years, she would have the same life insurance, whether she chose the free one, the 75% reduction, or no reduction, which has a very high premium. So I told her, I said, what you need to think about is how much life insurance will you need when you're at over 65? And she's like, well, I don't really need much now because she only has one child and he's grown and she's not currently married. So there's no one financially depending on her. So I said, go with the 75% reduction, because at least for the next 10 years, you'll just pay the ordinary premium just like you pay now as an employee, but you won't pay any additional premium. And once you turn 65, it's free. And even though it does reduce by 25%, you'll keep 1/4 of the value for the rest of your life for free, which sometimes we jokingly refer to as a burial benefit, because hopefully there'll be enough left to cover those final expenses. So if you have basic FEGLI, you will have to decide that when you retire. But by far and away, the 75% reduction is the most common, because we think in terms of we don't need as much life insurance when we're past age 65 for most of us, that we needed maybe when we were 25.
Sure. And the comment about not having a family to support, if that stays the same, which I imagine it would, then probably have a build up in other assets. Maybe the thrift isn't fully dissipated.
So there's other things you can leave your
Value of whatever assets one might have.
Yeah, because you hear that all the time. Well, I don't want it to reduce because I want to leave it to my kids. And meanwhile, the kids are 50 and 45. So they can still leave their TSP distribution. They can still leave what's left in any other accounts that they might have. But the life insurance, I think, serves a different purpose, especially considering the cost of it if you want to keep it.
Got it.
Very expensive.
All right. Let's get some phone calls in here. We want to beat the record of 6.
Uh-oh. We got to hurry up then.
All righty. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. We're on for about another half hour, so please give us a call. Let's go back to our friend in California again. A recent study by Morningstar found that the withdrawal rates should be 3% instead of 4% in order to last 30 years or more. They studied inflation, healthcare costs as the main culprits for this. Your thoughts? There was a rule, I won't say a rule, there was a common thought that if one retired at a certain age, they could take 4% out of their investment pot each year and never go broke. Well, with things costing more, healthcare, with just things in general costing more than what they did under this old law, I'm not talking about inflation. It just costs more to live than it used to when this thing was around. And so they ratchet it down and say 3%. I'm not so sure 3% is always the golden rule. Depends on what the market does. When the 4% rule, the market was more steady and it didn't have fluctuations. We've been having really nice fluctuations the right way recently, but we saw, like Tammy mentioned earlier, in 2008 where it really fluctuated down. So if you're taking out 3% and the value of your assets drop, whatever, let's not talk about the 40%, but if it goes down and you're kind of hooked into the 3%, you're you're really taking coals out of the fire.
But even if you took out 3% and you're only earning 1.5% because you stayed 100% G fund, you're going to start using principal the year you start taking a distribution. So I always want to address that thought about, you know, how should I manage my thrift? Because you meet so many people, even FERS employees, by the way, who have 100% of their money in G fund, and they've had it there since the day they started. So you can't tell that person to take out 3% a year because they're being so super conservative that it's like their money's in the bank account. As soon as they start spending it, they're spending down principal. So just divide their payment by how many payments they're going to get before it's dry. And so I think we need to do education, maybe not you and I, but you know, there's shows we've done on financial planning and making sure you're well diversified so that you have continued growth even in retirement. You're going to live hopefully another 30 years or more, and you want to keep it growing.
It's true. And this addresses what I think a lot of people look at. Where do I get my income? Well, I think the first thing is, where do I spend my money? If you don't know where you spend your money, or if you don't have a figure to shoot at, oh, this is nice, but you have to have at least what you're spending, but you have to pay taxes on top of it. So you really attack it the other way and say, okay, this is what I need. Where is it going to come from?
Well, I met with one of my neighbors yesterday, because every once in a while I'll sit down with a neighbor who says, well, what should I do about Social Security? And so we were sitting there, and he has a military retirement. He's been under FERS for only 15 years, but he's going to get 15% of his high three when he does retire. And he's got Social Security over his entire lifetime. And so between his military retirement and his FERS benefit, his basic FERS retirement, that's going to cover more than cover his living expenses every month, because him and his wife downsized. They live a fairly simple life. You know, they travel to see their kids mainly. So his Social Security, this guy can afford to delay it till he's 70 without, you know, dipping into his savings. His savings can stay intact until he's 70, which is what he plans to do, which is really nice. I mean, that's, to me, that's good planning or good luck, one of the two. But so in his case, he can let those savings keep accumulating longer. So just because he's retiring, he's not necessarily going to start taking withdrawals from his savings account.
I bet you made his day.
Yeah, he was real happy. And he told his wife, he says, oh, I was going to work another 4 years, but I might retire this year.
And she goes, no.
Yeah, so she was like, oh, wait a minute.
All righty, we have a call. Good morning.
Good morning to you both. I appreciate your years and years of outstanding service to the community.
Thank well, you. We have fun with it.
We started when we were 12. That's right.
I've actually gotten a lot of advice from you both over the years, and I just recently retired. I put my paperwork in April 3rd, and they are finishing out my final.
We lost you. Darn it.
I'm still here.
Okay, good. Yeah, now I hear you. Yeah, if you have your radio up, you might want to turn it down while you're talking, because I think it's feeding back on us.
Bottom line is that I've gotten good advice from you both over the years.
Good. It sounds like your retirement's going very quickly, too. You said it's being finalized.
I like to recommend is that people take a seminar from your company. Because me and my wife did that, though, and we were able to get great advice.
Thank you. We did not tell you to call, did we?
No.
But thank you.
The main reason why I call is because my father recently passed, and he was a federal employee, and I'm trying to find out the benefits that my mother would be entitled to.
Mm-hmm. Is your mom able to make the call herself to OPM, or is she in a nursing home?
She is able to make the call. She did make the call, and she has a death certificate. But I just wanted to find out, just to verify what she's doing, to make sure that she's doing the right thing.
Right. Yeah. So she's probably already been in contact then with the Office of Personnel Management, which is their retirement processing center in Boyers, Pennsylvania. And she's probably going to be entitled to, hopefully he left her survivor benefits from his retirement. And
yes,
there should, and there should be a little life insurance left if he continued his basic coverage into retirement. Even though it would have reduced, there should be some of that left as well. So the two things she should be looking for is a check from his FEGLI, his life insurance, and then the recurring survivor benefit. Now, depending on when your father retired, he may have had some money in the thrift.
No, he did not. That's
it was
one
before.
Thing he didn't do that, though. I did. You know, of course, I started in the beginning, and I'm one of those who got a lot of money.
Did well, yeah.
So, yeah, in that, I call that my boat money.
There you go.
Because I don't even know what to do with it. It's just so much money accumulated.
And isn't that great? Yeah, that's wonderful.
And then I even did that optional savings plan, too.
About
200K in that, though.
Perfect.
But one thing about that, though, as you mentioned today, they are taking a little longer to send me my check back for that, though.
Mm-hmm. Are you transferring it to an IRA, or what are you doing with it?
I'm actually transferring the interest to my thrift plan.
Perfect.
And I'm getting the check back because we may want to buy a vacation home somewhere.
Oh, okay.
That's probably what we're going to end up doing.
Very good.
Good for you.
Yeah, that's nice. So you must have been doing it for a while that you actually accumulated some interest in it.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I go back from the days where Mike Causey was
told you about it. Yeah. That's very nice.
The Washington Post, though. So
you got some of those 11% and 10% interest rate years, which
I did.
Very nice. Very good.
Yes, I did. I did do that.
Great.
But I wanted to say thank you for all your advice, and every federal employee should be listening to your show because they need to
pass the word.
Thank you. So sorry for your loss of your father, and best wishes in your retirement.
Amen.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you both.
Thanks.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Hey, great call.
Yeah. Could I go back to the other end of the beginning end of the spectrum? I notice more younger people in the pre-retirement class. It's not half the class, but there might be five of them in there that are clearly under 40 and some under 30.
Yeah, because a lot of agencies aren't offering a new employee seminar, which I think needs to start happening. And not to promote that for us, because we'll be long retired by then, but I really think agencies need to address that because of what you're going to say next.
Okay, so the comment is, I want to know what to do now. And some of the people in the class at that point will have expressed their frustration that they didn't save enough and et cetera, et cetera. And they kind of say, I don't want to be in the same position, so what can I do now? Now, you know, my answer would be, of course, put as much money into the thrift as you can. Their response would be, you know, my money's almost already spoken for. And then we'll talk about things. But I clearly don't know benefits like you do. Is there anything that they should look at to make their record straighter, to enhance their earning power? I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's great, because you always hear that at the end of every one of our seminars. I'm sure every evaluation within those seminars always say, I wish I would have heard this sooner. I wish I would have learned this 20 years ago. So you're right. So the younger employee is very smart to come to any kind of training for retirement so that they can look ahead and see, what do I need to do? So several things I'd tell that employee. Number one, they probably aren't planning to stay in federal service the rest of their career, because I don't know too many 20-year-olds or 30-year-olds who plan to make government service for sure their lifelong endeavor. Many of them think, I'll leave, you know, I won't necessarily stay. So I always make sure they understand their benefits in whole. You know, that anywhere from life insurance to health benefits to retirement. So they really understand what they're giving up whenever they go to that private sector career, because many of them will. You know, it's a given fact that many employees don't stay long enough to retire. So make sure you get a high enough salary so that you can save more, because you're probably not going to get a pension. Make sure that you understand the cost of health insurance when you retire at 57 from that private sector career, because you're going to have to pay the full freight. Or if you retire from the government, you still get the government contribution. So there's a lot of things that are kind of hidden outside of your salary that you really have to be aware of, that full value of that government career. Now, the other thing I make sure employees know throughout their federal career is to take responsibility. Don't rely on your personnel office to do everything for you, because they don't necessarily know everything about you. The only thing your benefits office knows about you is what's in your personnel folder and what's in your payroll office. So if you've done work before you came to that agency, make sure those records get put into your personnel folder, and make sure all of your records are maintained by you. Even though you have an official personnel folder, make sure you keep your personal personnel folder. Keep copies of everything. Don't rely on the agency to maintain that for you, whether it's electronic format or paper. You know, you really care about it more than anybody else. So just stay on top of it. And ask questions if you don't understand something.
Okay, your comment was right on target, and I'm going to have to ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we're talking about somebody relatively new in federal service or early mid-career. How many years in service would they have to get a basic annuity from the government?
Well, there's two things, because when I throw that question out to my class, I say, how long does it take to be vested until your retirement belongs to you? And a lot of times they'll answer 3 years. And probably the reason why they say that is because in the TSP, there's a three-year vesting requirement, meaning that the automatic 1%, the agency automatic contribution, belongs to you after you've worked for 3 years. Everything you've put in your TSP, everything that's been matched on your contributions, that's yours immediately. There's no vesting for that. That belongs to you. But on the FERS side, the FERS basic benefit, that pension benefit, or some people call it an annuity, but the FERS basic benefit, that's a five-year vesting. So once you've been a federal civilian employee for 5 years, now you have something to show for those years in the form of a pension or benefit or annuity, whatever you want to call it. It goes by all of the above. But now you have something to show, even if you left after 5 years. But if you left at 4.5, you get a refund of your contributions, which is that little 0.8%, but you don't get a retirement. So if you can hang in there 5 years, you'll have something to show.
Okay, so at the end of their career outside the federal government, they'd be entitled to an annuity of X. Now, is that annuity of X calculated on the compensation 25 years earlier?
Yeah, the deferred retirement so far has no COLA on it. So if you left at age 30, let's say with 10 years of service, then you would be entitled to 10% of your high three average salary when you left. And you may not be able to collect that, at least the unreduced amount, till you're 62. So you might be waiting 32 years, which is going to lose a lot of value from inflation. But at least it's something, which is, you know, we go through this in class all day. Something is better than
nothing.
Nothing. And we say that about a number of things. But, you know, this is one of those things. It may not be a lot to show for it, but, hey, it's something that you get to add to your other income.
Okay. May I ask another question?
Sure.
You mentioned health care, and the federal health care plan is second to none, both in quality and dollars. That same person that left after 5 years and put in a career of 20 years, 25 years outside the federal sector, would that 5 years qualify them to get the federal health insurance if they never went back to work for Uncle?
That was the key. So if they never went back to become federally employed again, then they would not be able to reinstate their health benefits. They'd only get to keep it for 18 months under temporary coverage, which is government's form of COBRA, but they couldn't reinstate it. So what I say to people is, if you can get rehired, even if you came back for 6 months, but if you could get rehired, you could reinstate your entitlement to not only an immediate annuity, but also to retain your health insurance. And if you're going to come back for 6 months, you might as well stay 3 years and get a new high three average. So
do that one more time, because that's really good information.
Yes.
That I don't think a lot of people know.
Well, I meet a lot of federal employees who are married to a spouse who might have left the government, like, you know, I did in 1988. So they've been gone ever since. And they say, well, is there anything my wife or my husband, whatever, can get for that 15 years or 8 years of service that they had? And I said, yes, and, you know, they can collect a deferred annuity as long as they didn't take a refund of their contributions. But if they come back, if they can get rehired, come back as a federal employee, even if it's for a short time, and I usually recommend try to stay 3 years so that your salary is replaced from what it was back in 1988. So if you can come back for 3 years, then you could get not only immediate retirement benefits, but you can also reinstate your health insurance and keep it for the rest of your life. And you'd be treated like any other federal retiree. But then the next thing they want to know is, well, don't you have to have your health insurance for 5 years? And the answer is you do. As long as you had it when you were working before, even if it was 30 years ago, that time counts towards your final 2 or 3 years or 6 months. And so as long as that's continuous 5 years, you still are entitled to keep the benefits, even if you don't get rehired for 5 years.
All right.
Interesting. Yeah, it's very
Thank
cool.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, I also get this question in class, and I bet you do too, because people use the term pension and annuity interchangeably. And the federal payment is an annuity. It comes on an IRS form from OPM, and it says annuity. Now, what is an annuity? It's an annual payment to somebody for their life. It's a promise by that organization. This organization happens to be the United States government, but it might be a purchased annuity where, for example, the thrift. You can have the thrift annuity, but the thrift doesn't pay it. MetLife pays it. And so MetLife promises to pay it. Why? It's a strong company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what is that? How is that different from a pension? Well, ask anybody that worked for Enron how their pension is doing. So money is put from a company, if you will, into a pension plan. The pension plan is there to pay somebody an annuity, but it might only last as long as the money that's in the pension plan is there. So that's the difference. And sometimes people get mad and say, oh, you're just playing the word game. And I said, well, you know, it's good information outside of this. If you were to go to work and somebody says, well, we'll put money into a pension plan for you, that doesn't mean it's going to be anything close to what they have in the federal sector.
Right. Yeah. One guy told me a long time ago, he said, you keep calling it a pension. You know, I was just starting out. He said, it's not a pension, because a pension is something where only the employer puts in and you don't put anything in, which I don't know if that's true or not. But in the government benefit, the FERS basic benefit and the civil service retirement, you and the government put into it. So it's definitely jointly contributed to, and it's based on a defined formula, your high three, your length of service. So what you put in it and what the government puts in it really has little to do with what you're going to get out of it. And as far as the safety of it paying you for the rest of your life, well, if this company runs dry, we got more to worry about than just our retirement benefit, because this is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. So a little more secure than Enron, I hope.
Yeah. All righty. The caller earlier had a really good answer to your question. What are you going to do with the principal from the voluntary contribution? And the comment was, no, I'm going to
spend it. Have a good time with it.
I'm going to spend it, where a lot of people just, you know, Roth IRA, no tax. There's nothing wrong with that. But I get the question in class, and I'm sure you do too. I want to take a chunk out of my thrift when I retire and put it on as a down payment or use the cash, or buy a boat so that I don't have that monthly payment. Well, they're going to buy a smaller boat because every dollar that comes out is going to be hit at whatever tax rate they're in. Forget what they withhold at. What is the true tax rate? And we kind of marched through that. Mm-hmm. So anybody with a federal and a state tax rate is probably paying 30% on the money when it comes out, even though it's withheld at 20%. And that really cuts down on your ability. So you can leave the money in the plan and finance, have
get a low
mortgage.
Interest rate. Yeah, a lot of people are offering low interest rates now that you can pay the payments and still earn more money on the balance in your thrift.
Yeah, and then they say, well, then I have to write a check. No, you don't. Do it electronically. Mm-hmm. And with regards to the thrift, I think everyone isn't aware that there are two types of monthly payments, series of monthly payments. One is based on an IRS life expectancy chart, where you're really not in the driver's seat. And the other one is you're telling them what you want each month, and you can change your mind once a year. So if your monthly payment was $500, you'd say take five, you probably need to take a little bit more than $500 out of the thrift because you have to pay taxes on it. But the point is, then you're in control.
What if I'm somebody who makes charitable contributions of $6,000 every year? If I told the TSP to send a payment of $500 a month directly to that charity, would I have to claim that as taxable income? I stumped you. I can see
your
wheels are turning.
This, it gets into a subset of another thing. If somebody very fortunate can move $100,000 out of an IRA into a charity, and it doesn't even show up on the radar screen.
Right.
So with regards to the thrift, I'm reasonably certain that they're going to show that as income. Of course, they're going to get the tax deduction, but it might not be a one-to-one offset.
And I'm wondering even, too, but I guess this is something we have to look into, is can you even tell the TSP to send it to that charity?
I don't think you can.
Yeah, so I think they can only send it to a retirement account or to you.
Right.
And if they send it to you, it's taxable.
So,
but here you go. Could you take it, move it to the IRA, and then tell the IRA to send it to the charity?
Bingo.
Yeah. Okay, so you can do it.
Yeah.
So if you're going to contribute anyway, rather than contribute out of your retirement income that's taxable, take it from your tax-deferred money, move it to the IRA, and then move it to the charity, and then you have a little extra money.
But you won't be able to do that in lumps. You'd have to do, use your $6,000, give me $500 a month, and I'll move it here once a year. I'll clear it out and put it into the charity.
Yeah.
Got it.
That might work. So if you're trying to find a way not to pay tax on your TSP distribution, well, just take your charitable contributions and take them out of your retirement money.
Take it out of the retirement. Do your tax planning, though, because sometimes in retirement, your tax deductions go down, and if you're below what's called a standard deduction, which more and more people are, this might not do what you want it to do.
Oh, okay.
Because they give you a flat amount, whether you make a donation or not.
Okay, so consult with someone.
Yeah, consult
who
with
knows
somebody.
Taxes.
Or just Google, a standard deduction and see how that impacts you. Look at your last year's tax return.
To see if it'll even help you.
Yeah.
Okay, that's something I just came to my mind. I think I heard it somewhere along the line.
No, it's good. There is a provision for somebody. It can be $100,000 or less, and they can move it directly out of their IRA into a charity, and it just escapes tax and it escapes even being reported, and it's more efficient than taking $100,000 out, including it as income, and then claiming it as a deduction.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That's a lot of money, too.
Well, if you have that laying around.
Yeah.
We're like the guy said, I have all that money in the thrift. I don't even know what to do with it. Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
I like to hear that because it means that, you know, it's working. You know, you're doing it right.
Got an email here that you and I both commented on last week, and it was an individual that does not live in the D.C. metro area, lives, let's call it the Midwest, and is stationed here, is working here, this is not military, is working here for 3 years, and they're going to take residence in one of the three local states, let's be specific, in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
This wouldn't work so much in D.C. So they're going to move to Virginia. And the question is Virginia going to tax them? We had some discussions and found that the individual is not necessarily going to be here all the time. They're going to commute back every weekend for a while or fairly often to the other home in the other state. However, most states are extremely tax hungry. And so Virginia, not to pick on Virginia, Maryland's the same way. If somebody earns a dollar in that state, and maybe that's extreme, if they earn money in the state, the state's going to want to tax it. I'll give you an example to really cement it. Somebody that plays sports. Take a football player that only has 16 games a year, eight of them on the road. Well, each one of those road States. Games, they're paying tax if the state has a tax, even though they might be a resident of a Florida or Texas, doesn't have an income tax.
Okay, so what if they live in a state that has an income tax and then they work in a state that has an income tax? They have to pay it in both?
Yes, they do. However, let's go back to our friend here that works in Virginia and is going to have to pay a tax of X percent. Virginia has a very low tax rate relative to a lot of other states in the country, 5.75%. Let's call it 6. And they pay 6% of whatever is taxable in Virginia. But the other state, and I looked it up, the other state, you can't have double taxation. You can't pay tax to both. So one state will give a credit based on
what you already paid in the other
right.
state. Okay, so you're not paying twice. You're just paying the higher of the two, basically.
All states, but about five, allow that. But what happens if the Virginia tax was greater than the tax in the home state? They're not going to give you the credit except for the tax that would be paid in the lower state. This state is not lower.
Yeah.
So I'm getting way out there with this stuff. But,
yeah. Does it matter, though? Because he was saying he's going to maintain his residence in the other state.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
That I emailed and I mm-hmm. said, well, you know, if you change residences, but I saw a later email, I think it came in last night, and they're not going to. So
no.
So no. But Virginia, you know, they had people I remember years ago that would drive around because Virginia is fairly densely populated around the D.C. with apartments, and they didn't have garages, and they drove around. This is true, and they looked for out-of-state tags.
Yeah. Well, we got that one time because when we first got married, we moved from Pennsylvania to Virginia, and we didn't get the new tags right away, and we got notices from Virginia saying, hey, got to get a tag, and that was when we had the big personal property tax. So I think that was motivation to get everybody registered in Virginia who lived there. Which we did.
Which you did. Well,
and we
of course
did. And
you
we did.
But of
it
course,
it took us
you
a
would.
Little while. Yeah.
All righty, Benny. What's a common misconception with regards to benefits at retirement age?
Well,
not so much beginning.
Yeah. Well, this question that came in kind of ties to that because this is a common question for people who don't understand this topic. And she says, "I want to retire in September of this year, September 2014." And she's trying to decide if she should wait till September 30th or September 20th, which is the end of a leave period, or go at the beginning of October, like she's, you know, this best date to retire thing. And so definitely not September 20th. Let's rule that one out right away, because if she retires September 20th, that's the day she's in a last day in a pay status. So for the next 7 days that are left in September, she wouldn't get paid. And the OPM is not going to send her a 10-day retirement check. So let's look at September 30th or possibly October 2nd or 3rd, whatever the end of that week is. And in that case, I'd probably say for her October 3rd because she's CSRS. So she can still get paid through October 3rd. She'll get her first retirement check for November 1st for the rest of October. So she should be okay. If she was FERS, I'd say go out September 30th because you don't have that three-day grace period under FERS where you could go out the first, second, or third of the month. So under FERS, typically it makes sense to retire the last day of the month. Under civil service, you can look at the last day, but if the first, second, or third of the month is a work day, then make it the first, second, or third of the month. So that's the most common question I get for some crazy reason.
Okay. Now, you publish that article once a month. Now, is that your most popular article?
It is. Yeah, and this all dates back. I have to give credit to Mike Causey because he's the one that discovered there is a magic date to retire, and he even named it that. So ever since then, this goes back to the early 1990s, we started talking about the magic retirement date, and it's just developed into this urban myth that people retire on the magic date even though they don't know why. So, and every month has a few magic dates. So it's not always the last of the year. And, you know, the end of the year is good for someone who has a lot of annual leave that they want to cash in, and they save it up the last year that they work.
All right. Now, if somebody wanted to read your most recent article about the best dates to retire, and I think it does it in reverse, too, the best dates maybe not to retire mm-hmm. in the coming year.
Yeah.
But that was just a couple weeks ago.
No, it's coming up. I drafted it a few weeks ago.
Yeah, because I saw it.
Yeah, it's going to come up. I don't know if it's this Friday or next. So it's coming up in the next 2 weeks on govexec.com.
Okay. All right, great. Now, we're running somewhat close to the end, and we mentioned that if you wanted to email us, you can. It's for F-O-R, your, Y-O-U-R, benefit, B-E-N-E-F-I-T, for your benefit, at NITP.INC.com, for your benefit, at NITP.INC.com. And you can do that 24/7. And you can ask us benefit questions. You can ask us finance questions, general legal questions.
Tax questions.
Tax questions. And you get an answer pretty quickly. We cannot make decisions for you. Don't ask us, should I do this?
We can point you in the right direction,
right, and
give you some resources or answer general questions.
Yeah, Tammy's responses always give you a lot of nice click-ons. Okay.
Yeah, some people like to phone call. Like, I think you like talking on the phone sometimes.
Yeah.
I'd rather email because then I can put links to other resources. I like people to learn how to do it themselves eventually.
Okay, one day I'll figure out how to cut and paste. All righty, so we're under 2 minutes. Final comments?
Well, there's one other thing that comes up a lot that is for FERS employees that they sometimes just don't know about. And only half of the FERS employees who retire get it. And it's called the FERS supplement, the FERS special supplement. And for employees who retire younger, phone call? Oh, okay. For employees who retire younger than 62 on an immediate unreduced benefit, they won't get Social Security, but they'll get this bridge payment that'll take the place of Social Security. So don't think that just because you're under FERS that you might not be able to retire at 57, because maybe you can.
And by the way, that supplement is not Social Security. It's coincidentally equal.
Right.
To
it is taxable.
But it is fully, it's pretty much fully subject to tax, and it's paid with the annuity form. It's not Social Security,
no,
which
COLA.
Is tax enhanced. Anyway, we're running down to the wire here. It's been great. It's been a long time since we did just the two of us.
Yep, it's fun. I like doing these.
We should do it again with the Roth, the BC, and the backdoor IRA. We do that every year. Anyway, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. And for Tammy Flanagan, co-host, and Bob Lines, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
What are NASA's key strategic goals? How is NASA expanding the boundaries of science, technology, and imagination? What is NASA doing to cultivate a risk-tolerant environment? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Charlie Bolden, NASA Administrator. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour. Tune in Mondays at 11 a.m. for the Business of Government Hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.